Welcome to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. On a hot summer's day at a walking conference in Girona, Catalonia, I am accompanying self-styled photo troubadour Jez Hastings on a short stroll. Jez has been known to walk to similar conferences, including a walk through Italy, Albania and Macedonia to reach a gathering in Prespas. Walking long distances is in his blood. We talk about why that is so, how and why Jez has developed his practice of a pace of purpose without purpose, of making art through experiencing landscapes on durational walks, and in taking fewer photographs. Here's a photographer who goes out walking without a camera.
Yes, very true.
So what's going on here? Tell us a little bit about your current practice.
As a walker and as a photographer, I've spent a lot of time trying to work out how to leave as little trace as possible. A long time ago, I was involved with the growth of the Leave No Trace movement. Before that, I was painting and I was making stuff. I slowly realised that the ethos of my ecology and the environment and all those things that I was involved with, mid-70s onwards, became a contradiction within my own art practice. And I'd always walked, and I was always interested in human power. And so I just started to kick back against that. So first of all, I would walk and make paintings as I went along, and I would pick up stones and I would pick stuff up and then take it back to the studio and make something of it afterwards. And then I realized that actually this was so sort of contrary to what I was talking about. The madness of that suddenly just sort of came to me, and I went, well, hang on a minute, I'm just taking this stuff. And I went to see several different artists work and talk with different artists, and there was a big exhibition that I went to see, and it was so shocking that this exhibition, people were loving this exhibition, and these pieces of nature had been removed from where they were and then packed up and then put on a boat, travel, you know, from the southern seas, as it were, all the way to England, and then reassembled and shown, and people going, oh, what wonderful landscape art. And it just sort of felt so bizarre that I had this sort of moment of going, oh, hang on a minute, what's this about? So I started to try and find, this was, you know, 15, 20 years ago, and I started to try and find a way of not doing that. So then I started making my own paints by picking up bits of earth. You know, I look back now, there was a compromise all the time. And I was still photographing, I was still making photographs. So it slowly came, and then a conversation with other people enabled me to think very, very carefully about what it was that I wanted to say as an artist. And if I wanted to talk about the experience of being, as the Swedish say, you know, in the nature, how does one actually disseminate that in a way? So it became less and less and less. And actually, really, ideally, what you should do is just walk. Yeah, not say anything about, but oh, by the way, I went for a walk. Okay, fine, thanks, bye. So I started to use a technique of storytelling that I learnt in the early 70s and the 80s and the 90s when I was in theatre and education, when everything was very exciting and, you know, fighting the state, etc., and giving power to moving the power from the actor or the artist to the audience. I kept on leaving more and more stuff at home or in the studio, and then just taking my camera out and just going, okay, do I need to work out how I document it? So first of all, it became a documentary, and then it became less and less of that, and it just became the image itself was of a moment of the walk. I wasn't looking for one, so that's what I do now. So I just make photograph of a moment. And there are plenty of times when I only make the photograph in my head.
The next side to this is that you do undertake long walks.
Yes.
I have heard some stories. So.
It started when I was very young, and I left the religious community that I was involved with, and I only had a rucksack and my feet, so I had to go. So I've always been quite comfortable with walking, and quite comfortable walking distances. So it's not a situation, it's not about being macho, you know, I'm a small wee guy. It's about that sort of expectation of just being part of the landscape, just being part of what it is to be part of. Now that's a bit weird. Yeah. You know, it's just, you know, just being in it and then experiencing that. And I feel extremely comfortable now, having done that for years. So, you know, I've walked in the northern Arctic area of Finland, and I've been in southern Africa, and I've been east in the Far East.
Wainwright, who said that, you know, there's no such thing as bad weather, it's bad
just play. Bad clue, yeah. Aye.
Are you a bit of a bivouac man? Are you sort of got a bivvy
bag? Bivvy your tent, isn't it? Well, it used to be just bivvy. And then you get to a certain age and you just think, I'm not here to punish myself. And of course, the equipment now is amazing. And one has to be really careful about being an equipment junkie. I've got a very lightweight tent now, which is almost like a bivouac. Sometimes I just take a tarp if it's a short journey out. But most of the times I like to have a little wee tent, which just disappears, you know, a comfortable sleeping bag and a mat and something to cook on.
Now, there are stories that, was it last year or a couple of years ago, you walked a Pespa?
Yes, that was in 2019, yes.
Where did you start to walk to Pespa?
Well, I started in England, but I didn't walk the whole way. So it started at the beginning. I decided that I would leave my house in northern England and just walk, and then got a bit sort of downtrodden because it became a thing of having to go somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, that's not what I do.
I'm going to say it was almost the flip of what you've just talked
exactly,
to me about.
Exactly, exactly. You know, yeah. And if I sort of wind the clock back a bit, I was lucky enough to walk in a residency with the last donkey traders in the Cevennes. We sort of created it as in the footsteps of Robert Louis Stevenson, Travels with a Donkey. And these donkey traders were having to go on their last journey. You know, it was incredibly sad because they'd been beaten into the ground by Amazon and DHL. So they would go from farm to farm in the Cevennes and the Lozère and pick up something from one farm and then take it to another. And then there was a societal thing, so they would have pick up the gossip, pick up the news, drop this to one farm, then drop it, you know, pick something else up. So they kind of never knew what was going to happen. They knew that on a Tuesday they were going to be here. And the farmers would go, oh, you're coming on Tuesday, okay, so I'll make sure I have some bread and some wine and everything. And every morning with these men and women, it's utterly brilliant. They loaded up their donkeys with all their kit and whatever the parcels were and bits of everything, really, from letters to lumps of prosciutto. They would then stand around, and at first it did my head in, and they'd stand around for, you know, about half an hour, roll up a cigarette, and then discuss about what place they were going to go, because that place would give them some. So Jean-Philippe said, oh yeah, so today we're going here, and Marie-Claire has some very nice wine, so we'll have a nice lunch. And then somebody would say, and the next day, oh, she has the best cheese, and, you know, so it was this sort of almost medieval journey that was being made. What was really fascinating was they never knew quite where they were going to end each day, because it depended on the start of the day and the middle of the day and on the weather and on the path and how the donkeys behaved, etc.
And how good the cheese was.
And how good the cheese was. How many cigarettes they had to roll. And then, of course, it was also a sadness because it was their last journey. But, you know, the good thing about the French tourist board is that they reinvent these things. So they created this thing. So they created this new tourism with walking with donkeys and got these people to do that. So that is quite a nice thing. And I haven't gone back to revisit them and chat about that. Every 3 or 4 weeks, they would do about 400 kilometres. It gave me this idea of having a really good pace of purpose without purpose. So when I started my journey to press this, a friend of mine said, well, you know, you're going to give a paper to a walking conference, and what will happen with this walking conference is everybody will be arriving by plane and they will all come and talk about walking. He said, so why don't you just walk there? Well, okay, fine. He said, you do stupid walks anyway. You know, this is just another walk. So what I did was I walked in between and got trains and then walked. And then I got to Italy and then I walked through parts of Italy. And then I decided that I would walk across Albania. I really wanted to go and visit this country. And I was really interested in the perception, and especially with the refugee situation and this horrible situation which is going on in Britain at the moment, there's this myth that you paint one group of people as other. I was told, don't go to Albania, you know, because it's, you know, they're like terrible people and they'll come and traffic you. And you know. So I went and I walked for 20 days, just over 20 days, without a map. I was told, if you were found with a walking map in Albania, the police would get very excited because the walking maps only come from the Russian military. But there's a guy in Newcastle who does was trading in them. I went to all the other map, you know, Stanford's. I went down to Stanford and said, have you got any map? No, blah, blah, blah. And the guys at Upton Pond 7, they're a very good map shop that I use. So then I then got in touch with the British Council in Greece. They were really helpful. And I said, you know, I'm making this journey, I'm not looking for anything, just for a bit of advice. And what do you think of these maps? And they said, dear Mr. Hastings, don't! You know, because if you get caught, the Albanian police will get really upset. Fair enough. So I had a compass. I had, you know, my old, whatever it was called, Blaex, you know, map of the area, which is, you know, motor vehicle map, and a compass. And I thought, okay, let's just leave it to chance and see what happens. And it was the most wonderful, great place to walk, because there's no rules, you know, because people still walk. It's a low-powered, human-powered community. You know, Tirana's a bit mad because they've got cars there, but everywhere else people just walk, or they have horses and donkeys, and then a few people have very old Mercedes. And then they have this extraordinary bus service. I didn't use, but they have this extraordinary bus service. The bus will only go when it's full.
I know that feeling.
It's just great. I love that.
I've waited a long time in South America. Uh-huh. That was very similar.
And in
Mexico. You'd wonder why the bus wasn't going.
Yeah, yeah.
You thought it was on a timetable.
Yeah, it's so sort of Northern European attitude. You know, a long time ago I was walking the edge of the Sahara into the mountains, and I came out in Morocco, and I, you know, saw a bus stop. It was great. So, and then I asked this old guy, I said, you know, when does the bus come? And he said, peut-être demain. You know, maybe tomorrow. So I had 3 maybes tomorrow, and then it was okay.
So you've walked loads of places. You've walked for long periods.
Yes.
How's it changed?
I don't know if it's actually changed me because I've always done it. I think now, especially with the rise of digitization, everything is much faster, so that's a real problem, and I find that myself, you probably do as well. It causes an impatience, so I have to then, you know, rein that impatience in and go, okay, this is what it sort of feeds me, as it were, the walking and the producing work from that, or as part of that. Yeah, so I think that's it keeps one fit.
Okay, but I mean, you've spent a lot of time on your own. The long walks are long walks.
Yes.
Time of solitariness. Was that something you were seeking when you were younger?
I probably think that if you live in a community, or if you grow up in a community, whatever that is, there is no private time, mm-hmm. you know. And I remember from the age of sort of 6 or 7 to 17 and a half, 18, my life was rung by the bell, you know, it was ruled by the bell. Everything that I did, you know, going to prayers in the morning, going to work in the garden, going to learn Latin, going to learn Greek, going to do exams, you know, ding, ding, you know. Other people I know embrace that. I'm just, my goodness, you know, if you can cope with that, cope with the ideology of a deity, you know, hats off to you, because, you know, it's fantastic afterlife insurance, isn't it? But for the rest of us, it's dreadful. So there's a duality. There's a fear of being on my own, because I don't know what that... And still, you know, I'm, you know, 61 now. You know, I still fear that, you know, when I go off, I think, how am I going to cope with this aloneness? But actually, it's a very comforting thing. You know, I have an amazing friend who I'm married to. She's great, so that's really good, and great kids, so they all just think I'm absolutely bonkers, you know. But when we come back and I publish a book, or a photo book, or have a small exhibition, you know, they go, oh yeah, okay, we get that now. You know, that's what drives you.
When you're doing these kind of this solitary long walks, walking with a purpose, without a purpose, was it? You
said. Yeah, yeah.
What sort of things do you think about, or do you not think about, or are you just observing and noticing all the time?
Yeah.
I mean, if you trained and worked as a photographer, you are looking for the shot.
Yes.
And have you managed to rid yourself of that?
Yes. And lots of friends who are photographers, we have this discussion. Mm. In fact, a very, very dear friend of mine, who's an accomplished photographer, was saying to me very recently, he was saying what he admires about, I hadn't really thought about it, was that you're not bothered about finding the photograph, because the photograph that you take, you will tell a story behind that. You have a story behind it. And he said, for so many photographers, it's so difficult. That's not taught, because everything is, you know, about how do you communicate visually? But actually, for me, it's how do you communicate using that piece of visuality with the voice and with the story.
I think that's interesting, because you and I are of similar age, and so we know life before digital.
Yes.
And I'm losing my memory in, you know, certain things. And, of course, the only things I have to prompt the memory are those dreadful holiday snaps that I took. And in a sense, they actually deplete the experience almost of remembering whatever happened in my life. Because I sort of look at these photographs, and many of them are posy, and many of them are, you know, of the touristic landscape shot or panorama view or picture of the cathedral. Mm. And yet I can't actually remember why I took that shot, or the purpose of it. I can see where you're coming from, or where you're going to, if that makes sense. Because
thank goodness one of us does.
No, because I think, I mean, every picture tells a story, they say, but in a sense, the story has more life almost, or longer life than the picture. The picture almost is sort of, I know the picture might last 100 years, but in a strange way, the story is more enriching to me than the photograph. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely.
I think that would stay in my mind more. Mm. And maybe that's why artists, visual artists, you mentioned yourself that you made paints.
Mm.
Maybe the concentration, the focus it takes to observe what it is that you really want to paint is probably as much as painting it. I don't know.
And also, there's an ephemerality about it, which is what walking is. It is ephemeral. If you say, "Oh, I walk," people go, "For what? Why?
Why?
Where, are you going somewhere? Or are you going to climb a mountain? Yeah. Or are you going
what
to do something? Or are you? Okay. The action of moving is quite delightful to me, you know. And I think also because I've never had a place that I have always belonged to. That helps a lot. So I sort of feel itinerant, and I've been lucky. I'm an old, white, English-speaking, educated guy. So already I'm on top of that tree.
Yeah.
I'm very, very aware of that.
And in a very privileged position.
An incredibly privileged position to choose this. But I think also coming back to why one does it, as it were, there is also quite a political stance within that, if you start peeling it back. So I've started this ridiculous thing at this ridiculous age, which is a PhD, because I'm trying to, it's not for a career move, that's a really bad career move, but it's to validate what I've done look back and go, what's this about? So I'm looking at how the image then informs people and how that story, and so this idea that I've got, which I haven't really opened out to anybody, it's called See Saw. I've been testing it with young people because I found out that they don't really look anymore at photos. They don't have time. Most of my work is either in a book or in a slide, because you can't mess about with slides. You've got to, once you've done it, you've done it, and there's no changing that or editing it. So that's another sort of limitation that I give myself. They each have a slide, so this is new way that I'm sort of working on how we have an exhibition, which fits in with my sort of idea of being a photo troubadour. Everything I can arrive with, I can arrive on my back. So everybody has a handheld viewer, which is run by natural light, mm-hmm. So there's no batteries, and we put a slide in of a particular walk. I give them the title of the walk, and we sit in the round. There's only maybe 20 people, and then I say, so what we're going to do is I invite anybody who wants to start talking about this slide, whatever they've got. And interesting, all the times that I've done it, somebody starts. Then they start talking about what they can see. They have no idea of where it was taken. I just give a title of the walk, walk into Prescott or along the River Wye or something. And then I tell them about why I made that photograph. At the moment, the walks that I'm making in Britain are extremely political because of climate change and land ownership. So I'm questioning poisoning the land. There's quite a lot of work I'm doing along the River Wye at the moment, where the river's getting completely poisoned. The only way I can describe it is capitalist idiocy. We've got to make more, so we can just pour our chicken poo into the river and spray anything. Some of these fields, I've found out, can be sprayed up to 7 times a year. Hang on. And I'm not there to make a demonstration about that, but I can talk about that, and then I read from my carnet, so I write notes in a carnet de voyage about the day or whatever that I've seen. I see they're texts rather than anything else, they're not poems or anything. And I read those out, and then we go on to the next one. And the conversations we have at the end, especially the young people, say, I've never looked at one, they only get a chance to look at one photograph. I've never spent 1.5 hours looking at one photograph. And they're really excited by it. So how does this sort of affect you looking at other things? And, this whole idea of slowing down, it isn't a deliberate, but it's enforced because they've chosen to be there.
Okay, you seem to be a happy man.
Yeah.
A happy man as you walk alone. Is there anything that bugs you?
Yeah, I think one of the things is that there's this, which always bugs me, this situation whereby there's this perception. And it's what Erling Kagger actually speaks about, of this sort of thing of doing something that's incredibly difficult because of the duration of it. I don't have that in my head. I have done some really stupid things, bicycling fast or walking fast or whatever, and record break it. But that's another story altogether. This is just about day after day. One of the things I do to fund all of this is I teach scything and dry stone walling and things. And we're so obsessed in the richer world about how far we can get and how far we can do each day. And one of the lovely things was, with the Albanian crossing and the Macedonia crossing, was that the Macedonians were never interested in where I'd been and how far I'd gone. Their question every day was, and it became a bit weird, was Kopishgon, where are you going? So I think that would be quite a name. I just love that.
Okay, now, right. You're going to recommend a couple of walks.
Okay, yes. There's, two physical walks, which have reference back to the 18th century and with Gilpin, who was talking about the picturesque, a painter and a priest, so not very far from my background. He was really interested in the disappearance of the pastoral. And there's lots of writing about that now, with James Rebanks and other farmers. The walk along the River Wye, you can do the whole lot, which is, 10, 12 days. Or what I recommend is there's a small bit, if you can't do that, the small bit from Llangurig up to almost to the source at Plinlimmon. And that's an extraordinary walk. You go through some extraordinary... But I won't give it away, but there is... I won't spoil it, because there is a big spoiler at the end. But it's a really interesting walk. And then the other one, which I would say is an utterly delightful walk, except for one gate that you have to cross the road, you have to trespass across, is the length of the River Duddon. So you go from the sea all the way to the top of the Roman road, there up to sort of Seathwaite that way, through Newfield. And it's, you just get this idea of another world, as it were, and the farmers are doing some really great stuff there.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. In this episode, you've heard from Jez Hastings. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we'd love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stuck of Rethinking Cities Limited, our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of Easytronic.